most kind of touching qualities that one, heartfelt qualities one experiences in Asia, in British countries in Asia, is their devotion, kind of heartfelt devotion, respect for the religious life. It's sometimes quite unquestioning. They don't demand that, make tremendous demands that it all be reasonable or rational, or that they just feel this sense of love, devotion, making of offerings, quite a spontaneous feeling they have. And it, of course, it starts from very much from being born into a culture where they prize charity and generosity. They think that is a very important, the kind of the ultimate, most important virtue for people, to be generous, charitable. Miserliness is really looked down on in any form, and being tight-fisted, miserly, mean, is considered quite contemptible. So that they, in these countries, of course, because of that, one feels a certain amount as a religious person, as a samana, as bhikkhu, that is quite a wonderful feeling to have around you. Oftentimes taken for granted. Sometimes Westerners are so arrogant and conceited they think that they deserve it, that they're kind of white gods or something, doing them, everyone a favor by living in Thailand or Sri Lanka. And we can be, white people can be very, very arrogant, conceited. But as you, say, partake more in the religious life there, it all becomes very humbling. When you ask what it's like for people to bow to you, and then probably some of you wonder, what do I feel when being the kind of focal point for all this bowing? Do you think it's something that is, from a selfish point of view, something really wonderful that I expect and look forward to and demand, that I'm just sitting around waiting for you all to just grovel in front of me? It makes me feel wonderful. Well, actually, when in Thailand, when people started bowing to me, it was before I was, even when I was a samanero, or first year as a bhikkhu, people would bow to me because of the respect they felt for the life I was living. But from the personal point of view, one didn't feel at all worthy. At least I didn't. I felt very unworthy of such respect. So I used to almost cringe. I remember in Wat Pa Pong, the lay people used to come like on a observance day, and that some of them would go and bow to Ajahn Chah, pay respect to Ajahn Chah, and then they'd come over. I was one of the last monks in the line. They'd do that to me. You know, I feel, no, don't. Do it to the next one. The sense of embarrassment, because being an American, of course, we don't bow to each other at all. Wouldn't even think of it, bowing to anyone. But then the effect it had on practice was that because this was so much a part of, ingrained into their cultural attitudes, it was so much what they wanted to do, and that one felt very much obligated to try to put more effort into being worthy of it. Well, if they're going to bow to me, at least I've got to be worthy of it, or I feel terrible. If I haven't been living according to the Vinaya, if I haven't been at least trying to practice with a pure heart and trying to put forth effort into this life, then I feel terrible when people come and bow to me. I feel guilt-ridden. But if I have been trying at least, doing the best I can, then I can appreciate what it means that I haven't been deceiving anyone. So it works in that way. It's like for all of you to use me as a focal point for bowing, I couldn't bear it if I wasn't at least trying to and putting forth effort towards being worthy of such respect. You just contemplate in your own life, would you want anyone to bow to your personality? I wouldn't. I wouldn't want to bow to have anyone. I wouldn't expect anyone to bow to me as a personality. I wouldn't bow to my own personality. Would not be anything that I would want anyone. If anyone was bowing to my personality, I would feel that was wrong for them to. They would be misguided. They're doing it in the wrong way. But they're bowing to. One is bowing to Sangha, to the Arya Pugala, to the noble beings, and so that this robe is a symbol for that. So anyone in the robe is a symbol for that nobility, the Arya Pugalas. Now putting on the robe and shaving the head, all that is taking away, say, that it's what we're doing is we're de-emphasizing personality. We're not here to emphasize our individual tendencies, abilities, class, caste, educational qualifications, race, nationality. Even that, you know, it's like, even though I'm the senior monk here, we really wear very much the same kind of robes, from the most junior bhikkhu to the most senior. This you see in Thailand, is the Sangharaja, the supreme patriarch of Thailand, like the Pope of Thai Buddhism, the supreme patriarch, Sangharaja, doesn't wear anything much different than this. He's not wearing brocaded capes and mitres and crowns and dripping with jewels and pearls, rubies and diamonds glittering on his fingers, bells on his toes. He just looks like quite just like any other monk, really. This is kind of the beauty of Theravada Buddhism is that the kind of rank and that we have no insignia for rank. When we meet each other, we have to more or less let each other know how long we've been in the order, but there's no way like stripes on your sangati or anything like that that anyone would ever know. In Thailand, they do have these ceremonial fans, which kind of convey rank. Like if you're a Sangharaja, you have an incredibly beautiful fan, signifying that rank. But these came after the Buddha. These are more or less a Thai adaptation to administrative. When a sangha becomes so big, you need to have administrators. You need to have house of cardinals, bishops, and so forth. So that they in Thailand they've set up an administrative structure with a sangha raja and somdets and jaukuns and prakrus and all that kind of thing. So these are kind of titled ranks for the worldly administration of a very large Buddhist sangha. But the insignias are quite separate, like a ceremonial fan rather than a robe or a crown. These are merely kind of for certain functions, not something you carry around with you all the time. You don't see them kind of walking around with their ceremonial fans, except maybe on some very special occasion when the king comes or a formal meeting of administrative monks. Because then the actual respect system goes from junior to senior. Even if a somdet with very high rank were junior, had not been a monk as long as just an ordinary bhikkhu, he would still be expected to pay respect to that ordinary bhikkhu because of his seniority or his wisdom. So in Thailand, of course, these ranks are oftentimes sought after, as monks can be quite worldly in their desires. So it's always kind of tempting, isn't it, to have rank, to have some important position, be acknowledged as somebody of importance. If you have a title like Tanjiao Kun or something, then that conveys that you're not just an ordinary bhikkhu, you have some kind of power, position. So that the corruption does creep in, can creep in because of just the way the human mind works and the worldly values of having status, isn't it? People wanting to have status in the system. Now the whole purpose of the Sangha is to relinquish status. If we've been princes and aristocrats, millionaires, sons of kings, sons of emperors, sons of dictators, daughters of dictators, princesses, queens, when all these things are relinquished. You're even supposed to relinquish your university degrees, which the Sri Lankan monks don't do. Sri Lankan monks love to have, could be called doctor with a PhD, but this is not really right, because doctor is a worldly title. So that doctor, if you have a PhD or something, according to Vinaya and to what is in the spirit of the bhikkhu life is to let go of that, not to think of yourself in those terms or try to convey that to other people, that somehow you are someone who has attained these worldly positions. Because they're of no value, no longer are they necessary, because status is not the purpose of our life. So then people say, well then why do people bow to you if you don't have status? But the purpose is not to have any status, but to live in a way that one is worthy of respect, to be that which is they live in a life of purity for the realization of nibbana. And whether people respect that or not, that's up to them. But it's not an expectation, not a demand on our part. Our status is to take the position of an alms mendicant, meaning one who is dependent on the kindness and good-heartedness of others. We don't demand, expect even, to really live our life so that we're not expecting or demanding anything. We don't expect people to give us anything. Or if we do expect it, then we watch that and let it go. We're not being carried away with expectations or demands. Now, some lay people think that because we don't expect or demand, then they don't have to do anything. That if we don't tell them or that, then they can just, that they want, maybe want to test us out or put us to the test, or they have form, like in England, people, English people sometimes form opinions about bhikkhus don't need anything, bhikkhus shouldn't ask for anything, bhikkhus should not be like this, should not be like that. And so they have these ideals for bhikkhus, but there's no love in their heart or real respect. They just have this kind of miserly attitude of not wanting to come forth as an act of devotion, but just to see what you can get away with, or give what you think they need. Give them what you think they should have. So that is a kind of meanness, isn't it? Meanness of heart, where the feeling of generosity is not really full, but you're giving people what you think they should have, what you imagine they should have. And it's still coming from a conceit and pride and a kind of miserliness, unkindness. Now the act of devotion is not to give people things that they don't need. Like in Thailand, sometimes they give television sets and these kind of things that are quite damaging to the Sangha. You have people who give things that are quite corrupting to the Sangha. And that, of course, the monks should definitely refuse or advise. Say these things are not to be, really not suitable. We appreciate the generous gesture, and we bless you for your kind-heartedness, wanting to give us something that you really like, but this is not suitable for a samana. This we can say. We don't have to accept everything that everybody offers. Now the community here, the ordained community, should really train. We train ourselves with these limits of being contented with what is offered, what is made available. What is trying to say how much we really need, what is really necessary, so that we have this kind of knowledge and this ability to be content. And really, after, if you train yourself, then you don't really expect anything or demand anything. Like not having money. Not having any money is to really if people give money to you or put it, give it to the office, then you should relinquish it unless you really need something. Not to have say, accounts and special stashes of money with your family or friends or with anyone in the office, or that, so that that money is to be, to, we're not to hold on to it, not to have rights over it, to be relinquished. Now this has a very good effect on the mind. I mean, if we have money and accounts and security, then of course our minds are caught up in that. We think about it. You can't help but think about it. And it also means that we're still, you know, receiving alms with our own, when we still have control over funds. So in a way it's cheating, isn't it? We could still buy our own things because we have this money, but then we're receiving alms. So that the whole point of the monastic life, the summit life of the samana, the alms mendicant, is to be truly penniless and take the risk of not getting anything. Now this doesn't mean that the lay community should sit around judging monks and nuns and being critical of them if they aren't living exactly to the letter or the way they want them to be, because this is when you idealize, when you hold perceptions about what monks and nuns should be, then all you can do is become suspicious and critical. If you see, you know, sometimes things just happen where you don't quite understand the situation, so that you tend to start suspecting things. For example, one time some important Thai man was told to come and visit Amaravati, and obviously was very suspicious of anything that wasn't purely Thai. And he's a very important man, and the people that wanted him to come knew he would be very influential and very supportive, had lots of money, and a very important man. But I guess he came and he saw what he thought was a monk and a nun going into the woods together. And so he left and went back to Thailand and told him that what he saw, or spread this around, that in Amaravati the monks and nuns go off together arm in arm into the woods. So the woman told me this. I explained, well, it could have been, you know, like there's these nuns, they wear brown, they might look like monks to a Thai, and maybe an anagari car. That could be part of it. They might have walked to the woods together or something. And she said, oh, is that, you have nuns in brown robes, yes. Now, if you investigate further, and you start, you can also see it in another way, isn't it? Oh, this suspicion, isn't it? As long as we expect and demand, like lay people, if you expect and demand too much of religious people, then you end up being first very dazzled and devoted, and as long as we hold up the ideal, and if you ever catch us doing anything a little bit off, then of course you feel very disappointed, very disillusioned. And I've seen this so much with people that, you know, get so high at first, so inspired, and then just through the process of living, things change, and then there's a great disillusionment. So sometimes you hear people say, I wouldn't give those monks anything. And in Thailand, you often sometimes hear people talk about all the kind of scandalous things. One of the great kind of gossipy subjects for conversation is what Buddhist monks do wrong. Somehow, when you're a public figure and a religious person, these things are the gossip really can fly around, especially if you go off a bit. If you do anything unconventional, unexpected. Now, being an alms mendicant and a samana, one who's living like this, then one can say feel quite rebellious sometimes. None of their business what I do. I can live my own life. Who are they to go around telling me who I can walk with and can't, and what I? The kind of childish rebelliousness arises, isn't it? It's very immature, isn't it? Somebody tells us to do something, I'm not going to do it. He's like a little child stomping his feet. So that we can just be rebellious, thumb our noses at the lay people, and do shocking things, just for the thrills of upsetting them, showing them that we're not going to be slaves to conformity. Or there's the other extreme, isn't there, of just constant anxiety about doing everything right, not offending anyone, not arousing any suspicion, being so careful, so meticulous, so fastidious, that everything we do has to be, we worry about, it becomes burdensome. We're always thinking, maybe we said the wrong thing, maybe we should have walked a bit slower, maybe we offended somebody because we didn't get on our knees soon enough. Maybe because we didn't bow to those monks, maybe they were terribly offended by that. Or we didn't point our hands in anjali, and maybe that person was very offended and upset, and maybe they think we don't respect them when we really do, and on like that. So that life can be a tremendous burden of anxiety because we want to be perfect, never upset anyone, never do anything wrong. Now those are the two extremes, aren't they? The blind conformist that makes everything into anxiety and worry, and the blind rebel. There's blindness, isn't it? Immaturity, foolishness. These two extremes are not to be encouraged. So reflection and confidence in our life, in our practice, then we realize that the world is the way it is. Sometimes the world praises us, adores us. Sometimes the world criticizes us, condemns us. But we're not in this life for praise, so we needn't feel any fear of condemnation. Why are we in this life? To realize the truth, realize nibbana, free from ignorance. That's the reason, that's the purpose, that's the goal. And I emphasize this as our goal of nibbana, even though you might not know quite exactly what that is. You can at least kind of think it out that it is the highest possible achievement and most useful attainment or realization, at least. It's a realization, not an attainment, of a human being. To realize truth and be free from delusion is the most wonderful, marvelous, praiseworthy realization in the human, on this human plane. So then we try to live our lives in a way that is mindful, respectful, sensitive, considerate. without becoming blind conformists. So then we don't feel, so that living under rules, under discipline, being public figures, being religious, obviously religious people, holy people, in the public eye, well, this is no longer burdensome. We don't make anything out of it for ourselves. The criticism is just that. The praise is just that. If people regard us as having status, then it's just that. It's something they create. It's not our expectation. If somebody thinks we're utter idiots, fools, then that's just that. It's what people think. It's not anything. We don't grasp it, and therefore we don't resent it. It's just what it is. But if we're in this outfit here to get praise, to impress people, to hear people say, how holy you are, how pure, how wonderful, I adore you, the holy life, and all that. If we expect that, then we're going to be very upset, very disillusioned when people think we've run off into the woods with one of the nuns. Or they see us, like doing something that they think is inappropriate. We're going to be very heartbroken, very upset. I've tried hard to be an impeccable monk all my life. Tried so hard, and then what happens? These scandals start, and I'm being accused of something I didn't do. Now I've been thrown out of Amaravati, rejected by the society, alone, humiliated, old and hungry, cold, naked, diseased. All over something I never really did. It's a put-up job. It's made up by somebody who wanted to do me in. But say, if I considered the purpose for my life to be abbot of a monastery and have the respect of the society, and this was what I was in this life for, then that would be a very miserable, depressing experience, wouldn't it? But if such an extreme of rejection, humiliation, and pain should happen, then if one is still practicing for the realization of Nibbana, it's no obstacle. It's just the way life happens to move. Nothing personal. Praised one day, cursed out the next day. It's just the movement of life and change and karma and so forth. It is no obstacle to Nibbana, to the realization of truth. So therefore, when we can really reflect on our attachments, if we're terribly worried and upset by criticism, then we can see that is a very weak point, because we want praise, isn't it? We're attached to the idea of being appreciated, loved, being praised, being respected. And so every time somebody criticizes us or condemns us in any way, then we're terribly heartbroken, upset, fed up, I've had enough, goodbye. We learn to just, praise is just that. People tell us how worthy, how honorable, how adorable we are. That's very pleasant to hear people thinking all these good thoughts and looking at you with respect and all that's lovely. It's nothing wrong, is it? It's not wrong to enjoy that, to appreciate being respected, but to be attached to it, expect it and demand it, then of course you're in the position of being disillusioned and depressed when they when you don't when something else happens to you, when the opposite. You also, if you're attached to that, then you're always going to worry about the possibility of it changing for the opposite, for the miserable side. If you see your position as having status, isn't it? Somehow having status in the society, then if somebody doesn't respect your status, then you feel very threatened and very angry. But when you reflect that the Buddhist samana has no status, meaning that we're not part of a class, we're not a class, we're those who have left the whole structure of the class system, the caste, the layman's values of status, we leave all that behind. And we take on the role of the mendicant, meaning the, like the one who depends on alms, like a beggar. Putting ourselves in a position of one who is dependent upon charity. So some people think we are just beggars, too lazy to go out and get a job. If you can get something for nothing, good for you. Good for you, isn't that what in that film? If you can get something for nothing, well, good for you. So if we are trying to get something for nothing, that's not very good for us, is it? And if we think we deserve, that we should be getting things for nothing, then that is wrong view. We're no longer an alms mendicant, we're a beggar. But an alms mendicant differs from being a beggar. How? Because we don't ask. We don't, and if we expect, we let go of expectation. We're not to demand. We're to live in a way that is worthy of respect, so that the alms given is from that real act of charity, of love, devotion from the lay community. Because they love us, what we're doing. They respect it. They respect us for our life, and so they find great joy, great happiness in sharing, in giving, in being generous. And this is what? This you can't organize, is it? You can't, it's not to be organized, like going around trying to make it work. It's, even though you can kind of set it up sometimes, the purpose really has to come from the heart itself. I mean, the center is really the heart, one's own heart. That purity, that pure intention, that determination to realize nirvana. That willingness to sacrifice everything for that. Now that sounds maybe very idealistic, but it's only till you really, really feel that the joy of sacrificing yourself. That's very joyful. To be able to sacrifice selfish interest, convenience, position, privacy, freedom, all these things that we tend to feel so attached to sacrifice anything and everything. The sense of real freedom. Because enslavement is always the selfish interest. Isn't it? And never being able to really give up anything, but always having little strings, little bridges that you can go back over, and little ways that you can get out of things, not burning the bridges, cutting the strings of life, but always kind of on the edges, half-heartedness. That story of Lot's wife in the Old Testament, that's the story of that, isn't it? When Sodom and Gomorrah are burning because they were so wicked, Lot and his wife fled. They got away and they got out of it, but she looked back longingly, and then she got been turned into a pillar of salt. What is a pillar of salt? And well, I don't quite know what that symbol means, but it's something probably you can't. It doesn't do anything very much. That's what some people are in life, aren't they? Just pillars of salt. Because they keep looking backward. They keep longing, looking and wanting to get, longing for the things of the past, or they don't keep the direction at Nibbana. They think, well, it would be nice to go to Nibbana if you didn't have to give up anything. I'd like to have Nibbana if I felt, you know, that I didn't have to give up anything at all. That's what Venerable Nanda and I will be going to America next week. You find this very common in America, the attitude of, we love, absolutely love Buddhism and meditation, but we don't really want to have to give anything up, because you can be enlightened as a layman. And, enlightenment is not putting on a robe and shaving your head, not handling money, being celibate. This is the, what are they saying when people talk like this? They say, I don't really want to have to give up anything. I don't want to have to sacrifice anything or sacrifice myself very much in any way, in any permanent way. Maybe meditation retreat now and then, and a few bouts of self-practice and so forth in the caves, or sitting in Sri Lanka, sitting in Thailand, sitting in Singapore, sitting in Japan, sitting in Honolulu. And what they're saying is, I want to get enlightened, but I don't want to have to sacrifice myself in any way. So what is enlightenment then to them? It's not certainly nothing really very well comprehended, is it? Because not really, it's still, enlightenment to them is what? Probably some form of happiness. Security and happiness. Well, you notice the Buddha himself established the monastic life on total insecurity. Being alms mendicant means that there's not any real security as such to it, is it? It's not like you can't hoard up food. You can't. Like when food we get, we have to give up. If there's anything left over, we have to give it up before 12 noon. We can't have money, so we can't have kind of money stashed away in Swiss banks. We can't till the soil, so we can't have our own little cabbage patch. We can't grow potatoes, rice, and so forth. We can't there's nothing much you can. I mean, everything is based on the on this sense of non-hoarding, non-accumulation, of fewness of needs, of total trust, of sadha, of total trust in Dhamma. Willing to risk day by day the possibility of starvation, hunger, not getting what we want. Shelter for the we reflect in our in our the places we sleep as a shelter for one night. Now, why did the Buddha establish a monastic order that could last 2,500 years on such precarious grounds? And it has lasted 2,530 years. It's a long time, isn't it? Not many institutions last that long. That it's there isn't many institutions. I can't think of any other institution that traces itself back to 2,530 years. Bank of America? The Westminster Bank? Switzerland? So obviously there's something to it. There's something quite in harmony with it, isn't there? There's something quite natural, the Dhamma Niyama, the laws of nature. It's in harmony with things. Because one thing that we see in our own minds that this sense of being of loving and devotion, this is what makes our lives beautiful. Trusting, isn't it? To be kind of like innocent again and trusting, not caught up in suspicion and jealousy and fear and anger and resentment and bitterness. And all this, we can hoard up money and property and all that, filled with bitterness and fear. And we can be billionaires and living in the most palatial palaces, castles, homes, and still be absolutely miserable. Joyless, depressed, suicidal. Now the realization of Dhamma, seeing the way things are, the ability to live in harmony with the way things are, somehow things work themselves out. But it is trust, isn't it? Our life is a total act of faith. Of trust in truth and in Dhamma. Even if it means that we, you know, the possibility of going hungry or being humiliated or rejected or whatever, this is, we're not asking for, or we're not trying to get out of that. But we trust in Dhamma so that our practice then comes from that. And this arouses the qualities in other people that bring them joy, make their lives meaningful, isn't it? To think of living in a society where everybody is totally selfish, everybody has everything they need, everything they want, everybody has everything they want, lots of money, lots of food, comfort, security, totally selfish. Imagine living in such a society where there's no generosity, no giving, no opportunity to give, no opportunity to serve. Everybody's self-sufficient, loaded with money. We don't need each other at all. I've got mine, Jack. I'm all right. And then we live within our own world of security, and yet that is a kind of hell realm, isn't it? To me it is. I find that really hellish, miserable, depressing thought to have to live like that. When you think of the risk of insecurity and of the opportunities to sacrifice oneself, even though sometimes one might doubt whether one could really rise to such noble opportunities, but still, we try, don't we? We move in that direction more and more. Because this is a matter of the heart, not of the head. It might look like to rational, intelligent people that we are utter fools. What fools they are. Irresponsible. Just kind of leeches, parasites on the society, that's all. Just trying to get something for nothing. Too lazy to go to work. So in one way it looks foolish, but as you understand Dhamma more and more, then you realize there's tremendous wisdom in that kind of foolishness. To be one who completely trusts in truth, in Dhamma. Now what comes our way, then we can feel grateful for, but it's not expected, not our demand. So if one lives in a place where everything is poor, and one has one meal a day, a shelter over the head for one night, if that is how we really, if that is our reflection, then we're quite grateful for that. We don't expect to have anything other than that. We don't demand. We reflect, we feel gratitude just for the rice given, or the potatoes, or the bamboo shoots, the frogs. Very difficult to feel grateful for frogs, actually. But anyway, we try, don't we? Then if suddenly we find ourselves in the midst of abundance, but still our reflection is on the fewness of needs and that, then we are grateful for abundance without attaching to it or expecting it or thinking that this is the way it should be all the time. So we're not frightened of wealth or abundance, have anything against having a nice place to live and delicious food, and it's not to be despised either, because it's an act of generosity. But the reflection on it is that it is from the same place, gratitude for what is offered for one meal, a roof over the head for one night, a robe to wear, medicine for illness. Now this keeps, I found this reflection very, very helpful for me in life here in England, because trying to adapt and live in a non-Buddhist country in a much colder climate than in Thailand. There was, what to think of living at the root of a tree in England is much more frightening prospect than in Thailand. living at the root of a tree in Thailand is really not such a bad place to live. It's all right. But living at the root of a tree here, I think at this time of the year, would be quite miserable, wouldn't it? In fact, all the year, really. So that one say might expect something more than the root of a tree, but I've never been actually. There's always been something better provided than the root of a tree. In fact, in Thailand, you used to go out deliberately to seeking roots of trees to live under, to get away from the nice cooties they make for you. Ajahn Pasano, he sometimes Wat Nanachat, he makes all the monks leave their cooties and live under the roots of trees during the hot season. They get kind of stuck into their little cooties and don't want to move. So he has them all the monks have to go out of their cooties and find a tree nearby and live at the root of it, their umbrellas. So that, I mean, you have, in Thailand, it's so easy to have a nice cootie. You could have, now they build very posh little cooties with air conditioning and refrigerators. Your own private loo, ceramic tiled, tasteful colors. Well, this little dream cooties was like this place, this monastery where I first lived when I was a Saman there. The cooties there were pretty crude in those days, 22 years ago. I lived in a little shack, really. And now, when I went back there last year, to this same monastery, they have little dream cooties now, little dream houses, tastefully decorated and built with nicely pointed up brickwork and mahogany doors, the whole thing, quite like better homes and gardens and ideal home habitat. So in Thailand you have to go out and look for the root of a tree, get tired of living in cute little houses and in dream houses. Here in England, we could live in tents, can't we, sometimes? We can live in wherever. But here in Amaravati, we try to provide suitable rooms. We're trying to improve them so that they're livable and you can keep warm, so that they're fairly attractive. I mean, we're not trying to dump you into kind of wretched holes and say, roof over the head for one night, shut up. You're not totally inhuman, kind of, expecting them you to say, oh, I mean, if you said, thank you, Venerable Sir, you'd really, we know you're an arahant. So that our life does, it has a certain, you can say, a security to it, an amazing kind of security that comes not from expectation, but just from the quality of life, from the faith, from the determination, from the goodness. This is coming from that alone. It's not due to any personal situation or anything. It's not, don't regard it. as taking it in any way personally, or that it's our right. It can only be good, only can be worthy if we are worthy of such generosity and kindness. So that is something that we can do, isn't it? We have a choice in this life, don't we? We can be good or bad. We can live just for ourselves alone, for our own convenience, selfish interests, or we can not. We can really move toward what is selfless and what is holy, what is truly beautiful, what is pure. This is our inclination to realize Nibbana, is to let go of that tendency to, out of fear, out of ignorance, to grasp at everything for personal security. Of course, the spiritual life does seem difficult to people. When you're standing at the outside or at the beginning of the journey, it can seem like a tremendously difficult way to live. But the more you let go, relinquish, sacrifice, the better it becomes, the better it is. A sense of relief, of joy, of serenity, peacefulness, the relief of not having, of being caught up in anxiety. Because even if you have £1 million in the bank, you still have anxiety with it, don't you? It's not real security, is it? Because the banks might fail, there's always the attachments to wealth always give people the tension and anxiety. So wealthy people suffer a lot. Some of the most unhappy people I meet are wealthy people, because they're just full of tension, anxiety, fear, with all that you would think would be give security. I'll say the beggar, you can think of it, reflect on this way, the beggar and the king, the two extremes. There's the king, there's the beggar. The king, say, stands for, the symbol for somebody who has everything. The highest position, the most money, the power, to have whatever they want, do whatever they want. The king is the symbol for the highest worldly position, where you have everything, and you don't really want anything, because all your needs are immediately met. So because you have everything, say, if there's a proper king, a good king, then you don't want anything, because you have everything. The beggar is a symbol for a human being that doesn't have anything and wants everything. And that a beggar wants any old thing, any old scrap of bread, anything, and everything, because he doesn't have anything. So then the bhikkhu, say, those are the two extremes, and the bhikkhu is the one who doesn't have anything and doesn't want anything. Or wants only what is necessary for survival. Whose intentions recognizing the need for survival. So just what is necessary for survival. So that, like, the four requisites is that kind of standard. What is basic for survival, or at a very low standard, that we can ask for. We can ask for medicines if we're sick. That we can do if we really need. We can ask for them. with food. We make ourselves, we go into inhabited areas and towns and to make, give opportunities for people to offer food. If we're really sick, starving, that we can even ask for food. With robes, if our robes are taken away and we're left naked, we can ask some lay people to give us one robe. So I mean, this is always, it's not a kind of hard standard, is it? But it is a reflection of how little one really needs as an individual human being. One doesn't really need a lot. There's plenty for everybody, in other words. There's plenty of food, plenty of places to live, plenty of clothes, medicinal requisites, if we only take what is necessary, what we need. We don't need to hoard up and save and have an abundance and a surplus, because we have faith, we have trust, generosity, kindness. We're willing to share what we have with others. And this is the joy of our human existence. This is a joyful life. It's beautiful to be a human being with a mind that is free from attachments. And the human mind expresses joy in being. What have you to be frightened of? Because we're frightened that we might not have enough to eat, frightened we might be humiliated, rejected, unloved, unwanted. Frightened we might be poor and diseased. Frightened that we're going to be hurt. We're going to be taken advantage of, exploited, mistreated. Frightened of this, frightened of that. But when you reflect and see Dhamma, then there's nothing to be frightened of. Because even what is frightening is Dhamma for us. We turn everything into Dhamma rather than into personal qualities of attainment or failure, success or failure. Now in the practice, you see that this, in your own, this subtle practice now, working with the mind, that any aiming for success or achievement, attainment in practice, can only bring failure, can't it? Even when you succeed, you're going to fail. If you're attached to any successes you have, the next time you're going to fail. That's the worldly dhammas. Success and failure, they go together. Happiness and suffering. Praise and blame. Having status or having no status. They go together. They're a pair. So as long as even your spiritual life is directed from worldly desires for attainment, achievement, for personal success, for bhava dhanha, vipava dhanha, then you're always going to be caught in the suffering of failure and despair, anguish, sorrow, grief, fear of death. So notice, and just now they say on tomorrow is the observance day, and then the next few days monks will be coming from the different branches. This meditation hall will be available when we want to come and have peace and quiet, so that. But to really reflect on the suffering of attachment. So that the more you really just let go of everything, sacrifice even the idea of attaining anything out of meditation, out of becoming anything or achieving anything. So then you won't feel despair at not having attained or achieved anything. If you have no desire to attain or achieve, then you're not going to feel despair. If you let go of desire, so then our life is what? One step at a time practice. The breath, the way things are. Our needs are few. Life flows and changes and moves according to its nature. Then we can observe it, learn from it, reflect on it, and no longer be free and no longer be attached or bound, deluded by it. This is the way out of suffering. So it's a different, totally different attitude than the worldly one, isn't it? So if your meditation practice is a fence because you're still going at it from worldly values, you're still looking at it in worldly ways, you're still taking it personally, you're still wanting to have become something, wanting to get rid of something. That's why it's so important to recognize this. It's these subtle forms of bhava, dhanha, vipava, dhanha that can completely delude us. So now take a short break.